This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Penn State, Syracuse University, the Catholic Church. These are just a few, the most publicized institutions that have been scandalized by child sex abuse. Many of the abusers have been caught and put in jail, but does that bring closure to the men who were abused? On today's Health Show, we'll speak to a psychotherapist about the emotional health issues facing male survivors of child sex abuse.
We'll also learn what officials in Massachusetts are doing to combat what they call the number one cause of preventable death in the state. And have you seen a commercial about a condition called COPD? Do you know what it is? You will. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Boys and men have always been sexually abused, but the issue is no longer being ignored or swept under the carpet. High-profile cases over the last decade have brought the abusers into the spotlight, and many have gone to jail. But that's not the end of the story for the men who were abused. Recovering from what could have been years of violence from a trusted adult can take a lifetime. Here to talk about that process is Dr. Howard Fratkin. Dr. Fratkin founded Affirmations, a center for psychotherapy and growth in Columbus, Ohio, in 1984, and is the co-chair of Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery. His new book is called Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. We spoke recently, and I mentioned that the abusers seem to be getting most of the attention in these well-publicized cases. Do we need to do more work to focus some attention on the abused?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done. It's really important that people understand that when a boy or a man is sexually victimized, it's something that he will struggle with probably for decades, at least for a long time. The shame that results, the devastation, the depression, oftentimes suicidality, difficulty with relationships, with trusting folks, there are just lots of ways in which sexual victimization takes a very serious toll on a man's quality of his life, on his emotional functioning. And you are right that oftentimes the focus goes to the person who perpetrated this violence, and all the attention goes to what he did or what she did, as the case may be, and not so much on what the consequence was, not only for the victims, but hearing these kinds of stories is also very difficult for people who are survivors from some other abuse, because it triggers them and it makes them have to go back and remember the very things that, in many cases, they've repressed.
You've been working with male survivors for quite some time now. Why did you put those experiences together in this book?
I wanted to write the book because I really wanted male survivors to know that it's absolutely possible not only to survive and to heal, but really to thrive. And I really wanted it to be the most encouraging book out there so that they would know that there are a lot of other men just like them. I called it Joining Forces because I was fortunate to have 20 male survivors who've been through our Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery who are alumni, and they've done a lot of work on themselves, and they were willing to share their story as well as their successes and what's helped them in their process of recovery. And so what's really important for survivors to know is that they're not alone. There's a lot of other men out there who also are struggling and who are reaching places in their lives where they're thriving and being really effective members of society and loving life. And I want them to know that that's possible for them too.
That fellowship seems extremely important in that one of the things you bring up in the book is the feeling of isolation.
Many male survivors will just keep this to themselves, and it really impacts upon their ability to get any kind of support for themselves. So it's really important if somebody is beginning recovery to find some other survivors out there who they can talk to. Fortunately, there's much more help out there. There are many more therapists who are trained. And it's really necessary if you're going to get through this, then you have to be able to speak the truth about it. But that takes a lot of courage.
In the book, you do have some of the myths of isolation. Could you go over a few of those?
Well, the major myth is that I'm safe isolating, that it's better for me to just keep this to myself, to never speak about it, and that if I do that, then it'll just go away. And victimization and its impact on us does not go away. It needs to be brought to the surface. There's some belief, some myth that if I do tell people, they're going to reject me. I think that's a huge one. And survivors are very scared about that, that others, whether it be other survivors or other men or even women in their lives, that people will judge them. They will judge them as being inadequate, that they weren't man enough. If they were man enough, they would have protected themselves. They would have stopped the abuse. And, of course, that's not true. No man can stop abuse. It's you're picked to be abused by a perpetrator because they know and they sense a man or a boy's vulnerability, and that's why the perpetration occurs in the first place. And really, it's not possible to stop it. Eventually, sometimes survivors are able to do that. If it's an ongoing thing, they eventually are able to find the courage. But that takes a lot of time, and unfortunately, sometimes these things are repeated over a long period of time. And so the man just keeps blaming himself, and he's very afraid that people will judge him for that. And so that's another reason why he might choose to isolate.
You put great importance on people telling their stories and the preparation someone really has to go through to tell their stories. What should, if someone is just has to get this story out, who should they go to? What should they prepare? What kind of thought process goes into that?
Well, I encourage people to think about kind of a traffic light signal in their head, a green light, yellow light, red light, and to think about the people in their life as whether or not they're green light people, that is, people who really they feel safe to talk about other things with, other problems in their life, or are they kind of yellow light people that are not quite so sure whether or not they might be judgmental or not, and then they're the red light people that are like, clearly that's somebody you wouldn't tell something to, and so you want to see if you can identify who in my life is a green light person, that at least I've shared some other things in my life. You might have to experiment. Maybe it's a man who just hasn't shared anything, any kind of secrets with other people or any kind of problems that he has. And so you might have to test the waters and find out who are the green light people. And if you can find somebody like that, they're going to be much more likely to be somebody who's going to be sensitive to this topic as well. So the first key is to find a safe person. That might be a psychotherapist, it might be a minister, it might be just a friend. But the important part is to find somebody who's going to be non-judgmental and somebody who hopefully will actually be supportive and helpful.
There are a lot of stories in this book, some of them pretty gruesome and graphic. Family seems to be extremely important with helping survive this, but some of those stories could actually break a family apart. It's really, some people find themselves caught in that trap.
Absolutely. I mean, there are all sorts of people who perpetrate sexual victimization, including family members. So if it happens to be your father or your mother, or your sister, or your brother, and they're the ones who are perpetrating the violence, and oftentimes this violence gets transferred from one person to another, from one sibling to the next sibling. So that definitely can break a family apart, especially if, say, it's your father who's abusing you and you go to your mother may be very invested in keeping the family together, and so she may be very likely, or she may be totally dependent on this man and be so afraid of what life will be like if the truth comes out that she'll tell the guy, you know, you're wrong. That couldn't possibly have happened. Your father's not like that, which is, of course, very devastating. So if it's within the family, that makes it very tough. If it's outside the family, it can still create lots of problems when people tell their stories, because a lot of times people just don't want to believe, you know, somebody like Jerry Sandusky. He was like this upstanding member of society, and everybody, he was well-respected in his community, and many people thought he couldn't possibly do those things.
You talk in the book also about finding self-forgiveness. That must mean there's a lot of feelings of guilt in this.
There's a tremendous amount of feelings of guilt, and I think it's one of the differences between men and women survivors is that men, because we are raised to believe that we're supposed to be strong, we're supposed to be powerful, we're supposed to be in control, that we tend to believe that it's our fault. And unfortunately, because of male sexualization, male sexual arousal, it's very normal when a person is victimized that they might be aroused. And so that's not something you can hide. And so a man oftentimes will take in that knowledge that he's aroused and think, I must have wanted this. And oftentimes perpetrators will point to that and say, you must have wanted this. And so a man tends to take in all that responsibility that it's his fault. He should have protected himself. He should have stopped it. And in order to heal, it is really important to be able to forgive yourself and to be able to go, I was wrong. It was not my fault. I took that on as if I was. And I talk in the book about being loyal to functionality. And that's part of being loyal to functionality, being able to forgive yourself, being able to say, I had zero responsibility here. This total responsibility for the abuse lays with the perpetrator. And the fact that I was not protected is something that I also can forgive myself for, because I couldn't have protected myself.
What is the difference between being abused as a young boy compared to being abused or raped as an adult? I mean, how do you, is there a track that both can go upon, or does it have to be, you know, two different ways?
Well, I think that a lot of the dynamics are the same. I think that adult rape survivors feel even much more shame because now you're an adult man. And so those messages that I was just talking about being strong and powerful and being in control, it's horribly shameful, whether it's a man or a woman who has abused you. And if it's a woman who's abused you or raped you, it's even worse. And women can rape men, which is another misconception. So, you know, if it's a woman, it's that much worse. If it's a man, especially if there's violence attached to it, and oftentimes in rape there is, certainly there's domination, the shame is so intense, and it makes it that much harder for a man to be able to get help and to feel like that they're not going to be judged is terrifying, because that belief is so strong that people will just see them as weak.
I started off by asking about so much attention being brought to the abuser. Is it important to see the abuser get what's coming to them, be brought to justice, or is that not even part of the recovery?
Well, it can be part of the recovery. I unfortunately do not have a lot of faith in our justice system. And, you know, I think the Sandusky case was unusual in that we had that many victims who were willing to come forward at the same time. I mean, that usually does not happen. So usually it's more about one person and one person's word. And unfortunately, the amount of psychological preparation it takes to be able to sustain going to court is very difficult. So I think it certainly can be helpful for some survivors, but it has to be done in their own time and when they're fully prepared to do that. And a lot of times, because of the law, because of the statute of limitations, people are forced into taking those steps long before they're actually emotionally ready. In that case, it can be really damaging. I've had cases where people did go through and sue their perpetrators or you know, file charges against them, and then they felt guilty when they were found guilty because they felt like they had ruined their life because they hadn't yet worked through their own guilt and their own shame. So I think it can be harmful, and sometimes it can be helpful, but it's certainly not necessary. What's much more important is to be able to heal your own self, to acknowledge your own truth, to get support, and to confront all the dysfunctional messages that people learn during their abuse experience and afterwards.
Well, earlier you spoke about weekends of recovery. Tell us about those and what you do during those.
The Weekends of Recovery are sponsored by our organization called Male Survivor. It's malesurvivor.org. And these weekends are experiential weekends, meaning that it's an opportunity where you get to be with 28 other men and you get to learn very specific skills that can help you in your healing. It's an opportunity to learn very specific skills and how to be safe in your body, how to trust other people, how to open up. You get an opportunity to tell the story of your abuse and be supported and believe like everyone has deserved. And we work on skills to help people leave the effects of their abuse behind them. We do some very different kinds of therapy. We do gestalt therapy, art therapy, movement therapy, do a lot of mindfulness practice. And so it really is an opportunity to form a brotherhood with 27 other men And we have 8 very skilled facilitators. Most of our facilitators have 20 to 30 years of experience as therapists working with male survivors. So it's an incredibly spiritual and powerful experience that men tell us changed their lives.
I imagine extremely emotional, too.
It's very emotional, and sometimes it's emotionally painful. Sometimes we just laugh our heads off. You know, it's a real roller coaster of going from one extreme to the other. But in the end, I think people leave feeling very full and very touched and moved and connected to themselves, to the playful, spontaneous part of them, as well as to that part of them that got wounded.
Well, finally, talk about laughing your head off. Tyler Perry, huh? Not bad.
Yeah. I was on the Oprah 200 show with Tyler and became friends with him, and he's been very supportive, and I was very deeply touched that he was willing to write the foreword for the book, and it was just a beautiful, inspiring piece, and he's a very courageous man, and I just have great respect for him.
Again, the name of Dr. Howard Fratkin's book is Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. It's published by Hay House.
Still to come, officials in Massachusetts are trying to find ways to cut down on drug use in the Commonwealth. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1286.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. According to a recently published report, smoking is still the leading cause of preventable death and disease in Massachusetts. However, illegal drugs are also a big problem for the state. The Health Show's Lucas Willard reports.
In a report by the Massachusetts Health Council, a statewide nonprofit agency that includes over 150 health-oriented organizations, tobacco use is still the leading cause of preventable illness and death among Massachusetts residents, with 9,000 deaths attributed annually to tobacco use. Joan Rubel, project coordinator at the Berkshire Tobacco Free Community Partnership, said that the near 9,000 figure is not surprising, and it's close to numbers she's seen in previous years. She says that there are ways that the state can invest more in preventing tobacco-related illness and death. She suggested more taxes on tobacco products besides cigarettes.
Cigarettes are highly taxed in Massachusetts, but other tobacco products aren't. They're cheap and they're accessible, they're flavored and appealing to kids.
Rubel also said that she'd like to see more insurance companies take strides to cover those trying to quit smoking. She said preventative steps will save patients and the healthcare system money.
You know, because there's plenty of evidence at this point that if you reduce the barriers to somebody making a quit attempt, they will be successful and the overall cost of the healthcare system will go down over time. It costs much less to help them quit than to cover their smoking-related illnesses in the future.
Rubel also said that in the Berkshires, more urban areas, including Pittsfield and North Adams, have a higher rate of nicotine addiction. The report was released just before the American Cancer Society's Great American Smokeout, Thursday, November 15th. According to the American Cancer Society and World Lung Foundation, an estimated 1 billion people will die across the globe during the 21st century due to the ill health effects caused by tobacco. The Society also says that in the United States, tobacco use is responsible for almost 1 in 5 deaths. The report by the Massachusetts Health Council also found that illicit drug use, including heroin, is on the rise in Massachusetts, especially in the eastern part of the state. According to the Associated Press, the council referenced a federal report that showed in 2011, Boston had the highest rate of emergency room visits related to illegal drugs among 11 11 major metropolitan areas. Heroin addiction is also becoming a serious problem in Berkshire County. At a community forum hosted by the Northern Berkshire Community Coalition last week, Detective John LeClaire of the North Adams Police Department and the Berkshire County Drug Task Force described the scope of the problem.
I would consider it an epidemic level.
LeClaire said that the increase in heroin addiction in Berkshire County is directly attributed to the rising rate of prescription drug abuse, including opioid painkillers. Lois Donis of the Northern Berkshire Community Coalition said at that meeting that there are 32 doses of addictive prescription medications available per person in Berkshire County. I'm Lucas Willard.
If you've watched a network newscast any time in the past year or two, you've heard about COPD. Not from the news, from the commercials. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, is a very severe respiratory condition where the lungs become partially blocked, making it very difficult to breathe over time. Joe Belinfi from the National Institutes of Health has more on the condition.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, is a very severe respiratory condition where the lungs become partially blocked, making it very difficult to breathe over time.
It's harder and harder to breathe.
Dr. James Kiley at the NIH's National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute says it is also known as a progressive airway obstruction.
Sometimes COPD is referred to in other ways, such as emphysema or chronic bronchitis.
He adds that COPD is the third leading cause of death in the United States.
And in 2009, it was estimated that about 132,000 people over the age of 45 died because of COPD. And of that number, about 69,000 of those deaths were women, as reported by the Centers for Disease Control. So you can see that COPD is a very, very serious public health problem that requires a lot of attention.
Estimates also indicate that about 12 million people have COPD.
Maybe what's even more telling than that number, if that doesn't impress you enough, is that there may be as many as 12 million more people in this country that have COPD and don't even know it.
Symptoms of COPD can include coughing and wheezing, shortness of breath, chest tightness, and other symptoms. Most people who have COPD are at least 40 years old when symptoms begin. The main risk factor for COPD is smoking. Dr. Kiley strongly recommends quitting.
It's in fact the best thing that you can do for your overall health. So we can't urge people who continue to smoke or active smokers to quit. It is really critical that they take that message very seriously. And all should talk with your doctor or your healthcare provider, because there are enormous numbers of tools and approaches and resources available to help people quit.
Dr. Kiley also emphasizes that COPD is a treatable disease.
We know that early detection can lead to effective treatments, so it's important to learn more and take action and ask about your having a lung function test and ask your provider to really assess your lungs as fully as possible.
For more information about COPD, visit the website copd.nhlbi.nih.gov. This is Joe Belinfi.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.